Chapter 8. To Russia with Gloves. Lenin Prospect, Murmansk. Mikhail Vasikin was growing impatient. For over 2 years now, he'd been on babysitting duty. At Britva's request. Not that it had actually been a request. The term request implies that you had a choice in the matter. You did not argue with Britva. You did not even protest quietly. The menedzer, or manager, was from the old school, where his word was law. Britva's instructions had been simple. Feed him, wash him, and if he doesn't come out of the coma in another year, kill him and dump the body in the cola. 2 weeks before the deadline, the Irishman had bolted upright in his bed. He awoke screaming a name. That name was Angeline. Kumar got such a shock he dropped the bottle of wine he was opening. The bottle smashed, piercing his Ferrucci loafers and cracking a big toenail. Toenails grow back, but Ferrucci loafers were hard to come by in the Arctic Circle. Mikhail had been forced to sit on his partner to stop him killing the hostage. So now they were playing the waiting game. Kidnapping was an established business, and there were rules. First, you sent the teaser note, or in this case, the email. Wait a few days to give the pigeon a chance to put some funds together. Then hit him with the ransom demand. They were locked in Mikhail's apartment on Lenin Prospect, waiting for the call from Britva. They didn't even dare to go out for air. Not that there was much to see. Murmansk is one of those Russian cities that had been poured directly from a concrete mould. The only time Lenin Prospect looked good was when it was buried in snow. Kumar emerged from the bedroom. His sharp features were stretched in disbelief.
He wants caviar, can you believe it? I give him a nice bowl of Strogernina, and he wants caviar, the ungrateful Ilansky.
Mikhail rolled his eyes. I liked him better asleep. Kumar nodded, spitting into the fireplace.
The sheets are too rough, he says. He's lucky I don't wrap him in a sack and roll him into the bay.
The phone rang, interrupting his empty threats.
This is it, my friend, Vasikin said, clapping Kumar on the shoulder. We're on our way.
Vasikin picked up the phone.
Yes? It's me, said a voice, made tinny by old wiring. Mr. Shut up, you idiot. Never use my name.
Mikhail swallowed. The menedzer didn't like to be connected with his various businesses, and that meant no paperwork and no mention of his name if it could be recorded. It was his custom to make calls while driving around the city, so that his location could not be triangulated.
I'm sorry, boss. You should be, continued the mafia kingpin. Now listen, and don't talk. You have nothing to contribute.
Vasikin covered the handset. Everything's fine, he whispered, giving Kumar the thumbs up. We're doing a great job.
The Fowls are a clever outfit, continued Britva. And I have no doubt they are concentrating on tracing the last email. But I spat... What did I tell you?
You said not to talk, Mr. Brit...
Sir. That's right. So send the ransom message, and then move Fowl to the drop point.
Mikhail paled.
The drop point? Yes, the drop point. No one will be looking for you there, I guarantee it. But again, with the talking, get yourself a spine, man. It's only for a couple of days. So you might lose a year off your life. It won't kill you.
Vasikin's brain churned, searching for an excuse. Nothing came.
Okay, boss, whatever you say.
That's right. Now listen to me. This is your big chance. Do this right, and you move up a couple of steps in the organization.
Vasikin grinned. A light of champagne and expensive cars beckoned.
If this man really is young Fowl's father, the boy will pay up. When you get the money, dump them both in the cola. I don't want any survivors to start a vendetta. Call me if there's any trouble.
Okay, boss.
Oh, and one more thing.
Yes?
Don't call me.
The line went dead. Vasikin was left staring at the handset, as though it were a handful of plague virus.
Well?
Asked Kumar.
We have to send the second message.
A broad grin split Kumar's face.
Excellent. At last this thing is nearly over.
Then we are to move the package to the drop zone.
The broad grin disappeared like a fox down a hole.
What? Now?
Yes, now.
Kumar paced the tiny living room.
This is crazy. Completely insane. Fowl cannot be here for a couple of days at the earliest. There's no need for us to spend 2 days breathing in that poison. What is the reasoning?
Mikhail extended the phone.
You tell him. I'm sure the menedzer will appreciate being told he is a madman.
Kamar sank onto the threadbare sofa, dropping his head into his hands. Will this thing never end? His partner fired up their ancient 16-megabyte hard drive.
I don't know for certain, he said, sending the pre-prepared message. But I do know what will happen if we don't do what Britva says.
Kamar sighed. I think I'll go shout at the prisoner for a while.
Will that help?
It won't, admitted Kamar. But it will make me feel better.
E-93, Arctic Shuttle Port. The Arctic Station had never been high on the fairy tourist list. Sure, icebergs and polar bears were pretty, but nothing was worth saturating your lungs with irradiated air for. Holly docked the shuttle in the only serviceable bay. The terminal itself resembled nothing more than a deserted warehouse. Static conveyor belts snaked along the floor, and low-level heating pipes rattled with insect life. Holly handed out human overcoats and gloves from an ancient locker.
Wrap up, my boys. It's cold outside.
Artemis did not need to be told. The terminal's solar batteries had long since shut down, and the ice's grip had cracked the walls like a nut in a vise.
Holly tossed Butler his coat from a distance. You know something, Butler? You stink, she said, laughing.
The manservant growled.
You and your radiation gel. I think my skin's changed color.
Don't worry about it. 50 years and it'll wash right off.
Butler buttoned a Cossack greatcoat up to his neck.
I don't know why you're all getting wrapped up. You've got the fancy suits.
The coats are camouflage, explained Holly, smearing rad gel on her face and neck. If we shield, the vibration makes the suits useless. Might as well dip your bones in a reactor core. So, for tonight only, we're all humans.
Artemis frowned. If the fairies couldn't shield, it would make rescuing his father all the more difficult. His evolving plan would have to be adjusted.
Less of the chat,
growled Root, pulling a bearskin hat over his pointed ears. We move out in 5. I want everybody armed and dangerous, even you, Fowl, if you're a little risk and support a weapon.
Artemis selected a fairy handgun from the shuttle's arsenal. He jacked the battery into its slot, flicking the setting up to 3.
Don't worry about me, Commander. I've been practicing. We have quite a stash of LEP weaponry at the manor.
Root's complexion cranked up one more notch.
Well, there's a big difference between stunning a cardboard cutout and a real person.
Artemis gave his vampire smile.
If everything proceeds according to plan, there'll be no need for weapons. The first stage is simplicity itself. We set up a surveillance post near Vasikin's apartment. When the opportunity arises, Butler will snatch our Russian friend, and the 5 of us can have a little chat. I'm sure that he will tell us everything we need to know under the influence of your mesmer. Then it'll be a simple matter to stun any guards and rescue my father.
Root pulled a heavy scarf over his mouth.
And what if things don't go according to plan?
Artemis's eyes were cold and determined.
Then, Commander, we'll have to improvise.
Holly felt a shiver rattle around her stomach, and it had nothing to do with the climate. The terminal was buried 20 meters below an ice pack. They took the courtesy elevator to the surface, and the party emerged into the Arctic night, looking for all the world like an adult and 3 children, albeit 3 children with inhuman weaponry clanking under every loose fold of cloth. Holly checked the GPS locator on her wrist.
We're in the Rostov district, Commander. 20 clicks north of Murmansk.
What's Foley got on the weather? I don't want to be caught in the middle of a blizzard miles from our destination.
No luck, I can't get a line. Magma flares must be still up.
Darvet! Swore Root. Well, I suppose we'll have to take our chances on foot. Butler, you're the expert here. You take point. Captain Short, bring up the rear. Feel free to boot any human backside if it lags behind.
Holly winked at Artemis.
No need to tell me twice, sir.
I'll bet there isn't, grunted Root,
with only the barest hint of a smile playing about his lips. The motley band trudged southeast by moonlight until they reached the railway line. Walking along the sleepers was the one place they could be safe from drifts and suckholes. Progress was slow. A northerly wind snaked through every pore in their clothing, and the cold attacked any exposed skin like 1,000,000 electric darts. There was little conversation. The Arctic had that effect on people, even if 3 of them were wearing coil-heated suits. Holly broke the silence. Something had been nagging at her for a while.
Tell me something, Fowl, she said from behind him. Your father. Is he like you?
Artemis's step faltered for an instant.
That's a strange question. Why do you ask? Well, you're no friend to the people. What if the man we're trying to rescue is the man who will destroy us? There was a long silence, broken only by the chattering of teeth. Holly saw Artemis's chin drop onto his chest. You've no cause to be alarmed, Captain. My father, though some of his ventures were undoubtedly illegal, is a noble man. The idea of harming another creature would be repugnant to him. Holly tugged her boot from 20 centimeters of snow. So, what happened to you? Artemis's breath came over his shoulder in icy sheets. I made a mistake. Holly squinted at the back of the human's head. Was this actual sincerity from Artemis Fowl? It was hard to believe. Even more surprising was the fact that she didn't know how to react, whether to extend the hand of forgiveness or the boot of retribution. Eventually, she decided to reserve judgment for the moment. They passed into a ravine, worn smooth by the whistling wind. Butler didn't like it. His soldier's sense was beating a tattoo on the inside of his skull. He raised a clenched fist. Root double-timed until he caught up. Trouble! Butler squinted into the snowfield, searching for footprints. Maybe. Nice spot for a surprise attack. Maybe. If anyone knew we were coming. Is that possible? Could someone know? Root snorted, breath forming clouds in the air before him. Impossible. The chute is totally isolated, and LEP security is the tightest on the planet. And that was when the Goblin hit squad soared over the ridge. Butler grabbed Artemis by the collar, unceremoniously flinging him into a drift. His other hand was already drawing his weapon. Keep your head down, Artemis! Time for me to earn my salary! Artemis would have responded testily had his head not been under a meter of snow. There were four goblins flying in loose formation, dark against the starlit sky. They quickly rose to 300 meters, making no attempt to conceal their presence. They neither attacked nor fled, simply hovered overhead. Goblins! Grunted Root, pulling a far-shoot neutrino rifle into his shoulder. Too stupid to live. All they had to do was pick us off. Butler picked a spot, spreading his legs for steadiness. Do we wait until we see the whites of their eyes, Commander? Goblin eyes don't have whites, responded Root. But even so, holster your weapon. Captain Short and I will stun them. No need for anyone to die. Butler slid the Sig Sauer into its pouch beneath his arm. It was next to useless at that range anyway. It would be interesting to see how Holly and Root handled themselves in a firefight. After all, Artemis's life was pretty much in their hands, not to mention his own. Butler glanced sideways. Holly and the commander were pumping the triggers of various weapons, without any result. Their weapons were as dead as mice in the snake pit. I don't understand it, muttered Root. I checked these myself. Artemis naturally was the first to figure it out. He shook the snow from his hair. Sabotage, he proclaimed, tossing aside the useless fairy handgun. There's no other alternative. This is why the Bois Kel needs soft-nosed weapons, because it has somehow disabled fairy lasers. But the commander was not listening, and neither was Butler. This was no time for clever deductions. This was a time for action. They were sitting ducks out here, dark against the pale Arctic glow. This theory was confirmed when several soft-nosed laser bursts bored hissing holes in the snow at their feet. Holly activated her helmet optics, zooming in on the enemy. It looks like one of them has a soft-nosed laser, sir. Something with a long barrel.
We need cover, fast!
Butler nodded.
Look, an overhang, under the ridge.
The manservant grabbed his charge by the collar, hoisting him aloft as easily as a child would lift a kitten. They struggled through the snow to the shelter of the overhang. Maybe a million years ago the ice had melted sufficiently for a layer to slump slightly, then freeze up again. The resulting wrinkle had somehow lasted through the ages and could now possibly save their lives. They dived underneath the lip, wriggling backwards against a wall of ice. The frozen canopy was easily thick enough to withstand gunfire from any conventional weapon. Butler shielded Artemis with his body, risking an upward glance.
Too far. I can't make them out. Holly!
Captain Short poked her head from under the frozen ledge, and her optics zoomed into focus.
Well, what are they up to?
Holly waited a beat until the figures sharpened.
Funny thing, she commented. They're all firing now, but
But what, Captain? Holly tapped her helmet to make sure the lenses were working. Maybe I'm getting some optics distortion, sir, but it looks like they're missing on purpose, shooting way over our heads. Butler felt the blood pounding in his brain.
That's a trap!
He roared, reaching beside him to grab Artemis. Everybody out! Everybody out! And that was when the goblin charges sent 50 tons of rock, ice, and snow tumbling to the ground. They nearly made it. Of course, nearly never won a bucket of squid at gnomish roulette. If it hadn't been for Butler, not one of the group would have survived. Something happened to him, an inexplicable surge of strength, not unlike the energy bursts that allow mothers to lift fallen trees off their children. The manservant grabbed Artemis and Holly, spinning them forward like stones across a pond. It wasn't a very dignified way to travel, but it certainly beat having your bones pulverized by falling ice. For the second time in as many minutes, Artemis landed nose first in a snowdrift. Behind him, Butler and Root were scrabbling from beneath the ledge, boots slipping on the icy surface. The air was rent by avalanche thunder, and the pack ice beneath them heaved and split. Thick chunks of rock and ice speared the cave's opening like bars. Butler and Root were trapped. Holly was on her feet, racing towards the commander. But what could she do? Throw herself back underneath the ledge?
Stay back, Captain, said Root into his helmet mic. That's an order.
Commander, Holly breathed. You're alive.
Somehow, came the reply. Butler's unconscious and we're pinned down. The ledge is on the point of collapsing. The only thing holding it up is the debris. If we brush that aside to get out...
They were alive then, at least. Trapped, but alive. A plan. They needed a plan. Holly found herself strangely calm. This was one of the qualities that made her such an excellent field agent. In times of excess stress, Captain Short had the ability to target a course of action, often the only viable course of action. In the combat simulator for her captain's exam, Holly had defeated insurmountable virtual enemies by blasting the projector. Technically, she defeated all her enemies, so the panel had to pass her. Holly spoke into her helmet mic. Commander, undo Butler's moonbelt and strap yourselves on. I'm going to haul you both out of there.
Roger, Harley. Do you need a python?
If you can get one out to me.
Stand by.
A python dart jetted through a gap in the icy bars, landing a meter from Holly's boots. The dart trailed a length of fine-grade cord. Holly snapped the python into the cord receptacle on her own belt, making sure there were no kinks in the line. Meanwhile, Artemis had dragged himself from the drift.
This plan is patently ridiculous,
he said, brushing the snow from his sleeves. You cannot hope to drag their combined weight with sufficient velocity to break the icicles and avoid being crushed.
I'm not going to drag them, snapped Holly.
Well then who is? Captain Short pointed down the track. There was a green train winding its way towards them.
That is, she said.
There were three goblins left. Their names were Denal, Amon, and Nile. Three rookies vying for the recently vacated lieutenant's spot. Lieutenant Pole had handed in his resignation when he strayed too close to the avalanche and been swatted by a 500-kilo pane of transparent ice. They hovered at 300 meters, well out of range. Of course, they weren't out of fairy weapon range, but LEP weapons weren't operational at the moment. Cowboy laboratory upgrades had seen to that.
That with thumb hole in Lieutenant Pole, whistled Amon. I could see right through him! And I don't mean that like you were the bad liar.
Goblins didn't get too attached to each other. Considering the amount of backstabbing, backbiting, and general vindictiveness that went on in the Bois Kell, it didn't pay to make any special friends.
What do you think?
Asked Denal, the handsome one, relatively speaking.
Maybe one of you guys should take a spin down there.
Amon snorted.
Sure thing. If we go down and get sparked by the big one, just how dumb do you think we are? The big one is out of the picture. I sparked him myself. Sweet shot.
My shot set off the avalanche, objected Nile, the baby of the gang. You're always claiming my kills.
What kills? The only thing you ever killed was a stinkworm, and that was by accident.
Rubbish, sulked Nile. I meant to kill that worm. It was bugging me.
Amon swooped between the two.
All right, keep your scales on, the pair of you. All we've got to do is throw a few rounds into the survivors from up here.
A nice plan, genius, sneered Denal. Except it won't work.
And why not?
Denal pointed below with a manicured nail.
Because they're boarding that train.
Four green carriages were winding in from the north. dragged along by an ancient diesel engine. A maelstrom of snow flurries coiled in its wake. Salvation, thought Holly. Or perhaps not. For some reason, the mere sight of the clanking locomotive set her stomach bubbling with acid. Still, she was in no position to be choosy. It's the Mayor chemical train, said Artemis. Holly glanced over her shoulder. Artemis seemed even paler than usual. The what?
Environmentalists worldwide call it
the green machine, something of an irony. It transports spent uranium and plutonium assemblies to the Mayak chemical combine for recycling. One driver locked up in the engine. No guards. Fully loaded, this thing is hotter than a nuclear submarine. And you know about this because... Artemis shrugged. I'd like to keep track of these things. After all, radiation is the world's problem. Holly could feel it now. Uranium tendrils eating through the rad gel on her cheeks. That train was poison. But it was her only chance of getting the commander out alive. This just keeps getting better and better, muttered Holly. The train was closer, obviously, motoring along at about 10 clicks an hour. No problem for Holly on her own, but with two men down and one next to useless mud boy, it was going to take quite a feat to get on board that locomotive. Holly spared a second to check on the goblins. They were holding steady at 300 meters. Goblins were no good at improvisation. This train was unexpected. It would take them at least a minute to work out a new strategy. The big hole in their fallen comrade might give them further pause for thought. Holly could feel the radiation emanating from the carriages, burning through the tiniest gap in the radiation gel, prickling her eyeballs. It was only a matter of time before her magic ran out. After that, she was living on borrowed time. No time to think about it now. Her priority was the commander. She had to get him out of there alive. If the Boiskel was brazen enough to mount an operation against the LEP, there was obviously something pretty big going on below ground. Whatever it was, Julius Root would be needed to spearhead the counterattack. She turned towards Artemis. Okay, my boy, we've got one shot at this. Grab onto whatever you can. Artemis couldn't hide an apprehensive shiver. Don't be afraid, Artemis, you can make it. Artemis bristled. It's cold, fairy. Human shiver in the cold. That's the spirit, said the LEP captain. And she began to run. The Python wire played out behind her like a harpoon cable, though it had the approximate grade of fishing line. The cable could easily suspend 2 struggling elephants. Artemis raced after her, as fast as his loafered feet could manage. They ran parallel to the tracks, feet crunching through the snow. Behind them the train grew closer, pushing a buffer of air before it. Artemis struggled to keep up. This was not for him, running and sweating. Combat, for heaven's sake! He was no soldier, he was a planner, a mastermind. The hurly-burly of actual conflict was best left to Butler and people like him. But his manservant wasn't there to take care of the physical tasks this time, and he never would be again if they didn't manage to board this train. Artemis's breath came short, crystallizing in front of his face, blurring his vision. The train had drawn level now, steel wheels spewing ice and sparks into the air. Second carriage! Panted Holly. There's a runner. Mind your footing. Runner? Artemis glanced behind. The second carriage was coming up fast, but the noise was blurring his vision. Was that possible? It was terrific. Unbearable. There, below the steel doors, a narrow board wide enough to stand on. Barely. Holly alighted easily, flattening herself against the carriage wall. She made it look so effortless. A simple skip, and she was safe from the grab of those pulverizing wheels. Come on, Fowl! Shouted Holly. Jump! Artemis tried. He really did. But the toe of his loafer snagged on a sleeper. He stumbled forward, pinwheeling for balance. A painful death came rushing up to meet him. 2 left feet, muttered Holly, grabbing her least favorite mud boy by the collar. Momentum swung Artemis forward, slamming him into the door like something out of a cartoon. The python cord was slapping against the carriage, only seconds left before Holly departed from the train as quickly as she'd arrived. The LEP captain searched for a strong point to anchor herself. Root and Buckler's weight may have been reduced by the moonbelt, but the jerk when it came would be more than sufficient to drag her from the locomotive. And if that happened, it was all over. Holly hooked one arm through a rung on the carriage's external ladder. She noticed magical sparks playing over a rip in her suit. They were counteracting the radiation damage. How much longer could her magic last under these conditions? Constant healing really took it out of a girl. She needed to complete the power-restoring ritual, and the sooner the better.
Holly was about to unclip the cable and attach it to one of the rungs when it snapped taut, pulling Holly's legs from beneath her. She held onto the rung grimly, fingernails digging into her own skin. On reflection, this plan needed a bit of work. Time seemed to stretch, elastic as the cord, and, for a moment, Holly thought her elbow would pop right out of its socket. Then the ice gave, and Root and Butler were twanged out of their icy tomb like a bolt from a crossbow. Seconds later, they slapped against the side of the train. Their reduced weight, keeping them aloft for now. But it was only a matter of time before what little gravity they had pushed them under the steel wheels. Artemis latched onto the rung beside her.
"What can I do?"
She nodded at a shoulder pocket.
"In there! A small vial! Take it out!"
Artemis ripped open the Velcro flap, pulling out a tiny spray bottle.
"Okay, got it! Good! Now it's up to you, Fal! Up and over!"
Artemis's mouth dropped open.
"Up and... yes, it's our only hope! We have to get this door open to reel in Butler and the Commander. There's a bend in the track 2 clicks away. If this train slows down even 1 revolution, they're gone."
Artemis nodded.
"The vial? Acid. For the lock. The mechanism's on the inside. Cover your face and squeeze. Give it the whole tube. Don't get any on you."
It was a long conversation under the circumstances, especially since every second was vital. Artemis did not waste another one on goodbyes. He dragged himself to the next rung, keeping the length of his body pressed close to the carriage. The wind was whipping along the length of the train, tiny motes of ice in every gust. They stung like bees. Nevertheless, Artemis pulled off his gloves with chattering teeth. Better frostbite than being crushed beneath the wheels. Upwards, one rung at a time, until his head poked above the carriage. Every shred of shelter was now gone. The air pounded his forehead, forcing itself down his throat. Artemis squinted through the blizzard along the carriage's roof. There, in the center, a skylight, across a desert of steel, blasted smooth as glass by the elements. Not a handhold within 5 meters. The strength of a rhino would be of no use here, Artemis decided. At last, an opportunity to use his brain. Kinetics and momentum. Simple enough, in theory. Keeping to the front rim of the carriage, Artemis inched onto the roof. The wind wormed beneath his legs, raising them 5 centimeters from the deck, threatening to float him off the train. Artemis curled his fingers around the rim. These were not gripping fingers. Artemis hadn't gripped anything bigger than his mobile phone in several months. If you wanted someone to type Paradise Lost in under 20 minutes, then Artemis was your man. But as for hanging onto carriage roofs in a blizzard, dead loss. Which, fortunately, was all part of the plan. A millisecond before his finger joints parted company, Artemis let go. The slipstream shot him straight through the skylight's metal housing. "Perfect," he would have grunted, had there been a cubic centimeter of air in his lungs. But even if he had said it, the wind would have snatched away any words before his own ears heard them. He had moments now before the wind dug its fingers beneath his torso, flipping him onto the icy steps. Cannon fodder for the goblins. Artemis fumbled the acid vial from his pocket, snapping the top between his teeth. A fleck of the acid flew past his eye. No time to worry about that now. No time for anything. The skylight was secured by a thick padlock. Artemis dribbled 2 drops into the keyhole. All he could spare. It would have to be enough. The effect was immediate. The acid ate through the metal like lava through ice. Fairy technology, best under the world. The padlock pinged open, exposing the hatch to the wind's power. It flipped upwards, and Artemis tumbled through onto a pallet of barrels. Not exactly the picture of a gallant rescuer. The train's motion shook him from the cargo. Artemis landed face up, gazing at the triple-triangled symbol for radiation stamped on the side of each container. At least the barrels were sealed, though rust seemed to have taken hold on quite a few. Artemis rolled across the slatted floor, clambering to his knees alongside the door. Was Captain Short still anchored there? Or was he alone now? For the first time in his life. Truly, alone.
"Foul! Open the door, you pasty-faced mud weasel!"
Ah, well, not alone, then. Covering his face with a forearm, Artemis drenched the carriage's triple bolt with fairy acid. The steel lock melted instantly, dripping to the floor like a stream of mercury. Artemis dragged the sliding door back. Holly was hanging on grimly, her face steaming where radiation was eating through the gel. Artemis grabbed her waistband.
"On three!"
Holly nodded. No more energy for speech. Artemis flexed his digits. "Fingers, don't fail me now." If he ever got out of this, he would buy one of those ridiculous home gymnasiums advertised on the shopping channels.
"One!"
The bend was coming.
He could see it out of the corner of his eye. The train would slow down or derail itself.
Two!
Captain Short's strength was almost spent. The wind rippled her frame like a windsock.
Three!
Artemis pulled with all the strength in his thin arms. Holly closed her eyes and let go, unable to believe she was trusting her life to this mud boy.
Artemis knew a little something about physics. He timed his count to take advantage of swing, momentum, and the train's own forward motion. But nature always throws something into the mix that can't be anticipated. In this case, the something was a slight gap between two sections of the track. Not enough to derail a locomotive, but certainly enough to cause a bump. This bump sent the carriage door crashing into its frame like a 5-ton guillotine. But it looked like Holly had made it. Artemis couldn't really tell because she'd crashed into him, sending them both careering into the wooden siding. She seemed to be intact, from what he could see. At least her head was still attached to her neck, which was good. But she did seem to be unconscious. Probably trauma. Artemis knew that he was going to pass out too. He could tell by the darkness eating at the corners of his vision, like some malignant computer virus. He slipped sideways, landing on Holly's chest. This had more severe repercussions than you might think. Because Holly was unconscious, her magic was on autopilot, and unsupervised magic flows like electricity. Artemis's face made contact with the fairy's left hand, diverting the flow of blue sparks. And while this was good for him, it was most definitely bad for her. Because although Artemis didn't know it, Holly needed every spark of magic she could muster. Not all of her had made it inside the train. Commander Root had just activated his Python cord winch when he received a most unexpected poke in the eye. The Goblin Denal removed a small rectangular mirror from his tunic and checked his scales were smooth.
"These cowboy wings are great. You think we'll be allowed to keep them?"
Amon scowled. Not that you'd notice. Goblin lizard ancestry meant that facial movement was pretty limited.
"Quiet, you hot-blooded fool!"
Hot-blooded? That was a pretty serious insult for one of the Bois Kel. Denal bristled.
"Be careful, friend, or I'll tear that forked tongue right out of your head."
"We won't have a forked tongue between us if those elves escape," retorted Amon.
It was true. The generals did not take disappointment well.
"So what do we do? I've got the look in the outfit. That makes you the brains."
"We shoot at the train,"
interjected Niall.
"Simple."
Denal adjusted his cowboy double decks, hovering across to the squad's junior member.
"Idiot,"
he snapped, administering a swift slap to the head.
"That thing is radioactive. Can't you smell it? One stray burst and we'll all be ash floating on the breeze."
"Good point,"
admitted Niall.
"You're not as stupid as you look."
"Thank you."
"Welcome."
Amon throttled down, descending to 150 meters. It was so tempting. One tightly focused burst to take out the elf clinging to the carriage, another to dispatch the human on the roof. But he couldn't risk it. 1 degree off target, and he sucked his last stinkworm spaghetti.
"Okay,"
he announced into his helmet mic.
"Here's the plan. With all the radiation in that carriage, chances are the target will be dead in minutes. We follow the train for a while just to make sure. Then we go back and tell the general we saw the bodies."
Denal buzzed down beside him.
"And do we see the bodies?"
Amon groaned.
"Of course not, you fool. Do you want your eyeballs to dry up and fall out?"
"Duh."
"Exactly. So we're clear." "Crystal,"
said Niall, drawing his soft-nosed red boy handgun. He shot his comrades from behind. Close range. Point blank. They never had a chance. He followed their bodies to Earth on full magnification. The snow would cover them in minutes. Nobody would be stumbling over those particular corpses until the polar ice caps melted. Niall holstered his weapon, punching in the coordinates for the shuttle terminal on his flight computer. If you studied his reptilian face carefully, it was just possible to make out a grin. There was a new lieutenant in town.